I would have registration periods and we're very close to election. I would have a standing norm of in-person on paper ballot voting with an ID rather than absentee ballots and some of these other things that are easier to game in various kinds of ways. All of these things probably lead to fewer voters, but I think they would still be worthwhile things to pursue. I think at some point we're going to have a real conversation about who counts as an adult in the United States. And if you can't buy a handgun and you can't buy a beer, but you can join the army and you can vote, that's kind of a weird, unsustainable situation, I think, in a lot of ways. I know there are historical reasons for having it that way.
Hey, everybody, and welcome back to the show. I've got a great guest with me here today, Kevin Williamson from National Review. Now, I'm having Kevin on today to discuss the issue of voting, which has been on everyone's mind because of some legislation in Georgia and other places. So, Kevin, thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you.
Yeah, so let's talk about this because you had kind of a contrarian take, very out of unusual for you, about this issue where you wrote an article basically saying, obviously, people have called the Democrat legislation, the Georgia legislation, some people have called it Jim Crow or voter suppression, and that's very much overblown. Yeah. If anything, it may marginally decrease voting access or marginally increasing it, depending how you look at it. But you just took the general issue of voting and you argued, why not less voting? Why is that inherently bad? So maybe just make your case to us in a nutshell.
Sure. Well, I wasn't writing in this case about the particular legislation in Georgia, although I'm certainly happy to talk about that if you want to. It's a bad argument that anything we do to enhance the security or integrity of elections that also makes it more difficult for people to vote should be rejected for that reason. So there are things we do that lead to fewer voters that are perfectly good and sensible policies, for instance, requiring voter registration, checking ID, that sort of thing. I'm a longtime advocate of the disenfranchisement of felons, among other things, although I think we have far too many things for which you can be convicted of a felony. I'm in that very narrow window of people who want to legalize drugs, but also disenfranchise felons. So although I guess we could re-enfranchise all the ones who have been disenfranchised on drug charges after we've gotten rid of those silly laws. So it's a bad argument simply that anything that leads to fewer voters is a bad idea for that reason. And I think that becomes more obvious if you take, you know, the opposite position of saying, well, let's stop checking IDs, let's stop having voter registration, let's stop doing any kind of confirmation or oversight. And well, people would say, obviously, you don't want to do that either. So, but those things, of course, lead to fewer voters as well. There'd probably be more people who voted if you didn't have to go through a separate registration process. There'd be more people who voted if other sorts of restrictions were lifted. There'd be more people who voted if we lowered the voting age to 15. There would be more people who voted if we allowed people who are currently incarcerated to vote. I don't think these would be improvements in the system. So I'm a little bit like, in this much anyway, some of the early American founding fathers, and particularly Adams, that had a pretty negative attitude about democracy to the extent that they didn't even like the word. Adams famously wrote very bitterly about democracy, but even as late as Abraham Lincoln, the word was used as a term of opprobrium. He referred to the Democratic Party as the corrupt democracy, that sort of thing. So democracy, I don't really think, is something that's a really great inherent moral good. I look at democracy as being a utilitarian thing. It's a very important utilitarian thing. It's a way that we make decisions about how government gets organized and who gets chosen to represent us. There's not another good way to do it. So I'm glad we have it for that reason. But the idea of, you know, gross majoritarianism, that a policy or an idea or a principle becomes good or right or justified or vindicated because 50% plus one of the population supports it, I think is absurd and very difficult to support. There are times in American history where I'm quite sure that if you'd had an election on issues that we now think are important, that what we now think of as the wrong side would have won, certainly. And there are countries that have had really very limited democratic participation up into the modern era that are quite well-governed, good countries. Again, I'll get pilloried for noticing this, but let me just preface this by saying this is not something I want to replicate in the United States. But, you know, there were parts of Switzerland that didn't give women the vote until the 1990s. And Switzerland's not Afghanistan. It's not some savage, backward place. And women in Switzerland weren't oppressed during this period of time. Now, I think women should have been given the right to vote the same as men. I don't think that's a very good criterion for denying someone the vote or for giving someone the vote. But it's an example of ways in which the franchise has been limited in well-governed countries.
Yeah, and so I guess underlying this whole conversation, because I think I agree with you, most conservatives would, unfettered democracy isn't a good thing. That's why we have the First Amendment and the Second Amendment. Some rights are supposed to be beyond the bounds of 51%. But I think a lot of people do view, though, basically governing with the consent of the governed. They do view voting as a right. Do you?
No, and I'm not sure that voting and legitimacy are tied together in particularly that way. And certainly I'm quite sure that voting and good government are not tied together in that way. You know, so I began my career in India, which is a country I admire in lots of ways, but it's not famously a very well-governed country, although it has very, very, a very robust democracy with lots of public participation, lots of voting. Whereas you take a place like Singapore, not a very democratic government in most ways, but probably by most metrics, a better government and a better place to live for a lot of people than India still is. The United States has been better governed, I think, at times when it had more restrictions on kind of majoritarianism than it does now, when we had a Supreme Court that took a narrower view of federal powers and that sort of thing. And I think it's important to understand that you know, the anti-majoritarian and anti-democratic aspects of American government are really a fundamental part of our constitutional architecture. We got a Bill of Rights for a reason, which means you people don't get to vote on this stuff. It doesn't matter if 100% of the people come out and say, we don't want to have free speech anymore. It still says what it says. You don't get to overturn that just by passing a statute. Now, you can do a constitutional amendment and repeal the First Amendment, but that's a very difficult thing to do, which is why we set it up that way to begin with. Freedom of religion and freedom from, you know, unreasonable arrest and from arbitrary detention and all these things that are very important. You don't get to vote on. These are just put beyond that. The original organization of our government, with a Senate that wasn't directly elected, with presidents that still aren't really directly elected, although they're very close to that now, I think. These were partly the result of organizing a bunch of independent states into a union of states, but partly also the result of the fact that the founders did understand that kind of ranked democracy was dangerous and not really a very good way to organize a country. Now, that was a pretty small, homogenous, relatively easily governed country at that point. We're a big, highly populated, diverse, complex country now. And I think that the tendency to want to have a kind of national model of everything determined by 50% plus one of the population is a recipe for instability and for bad governance and for chaos, ultimately.
But I guess one thing that I did wonder while I was reading your article is, I think I'm largely on board, and a lot of people might be, with the idea that the average voter is not very well informed, and more people voting does not mean better public policy. Some very bad public policies have overwhelming public support because they sound good. But there is an ugly history in this country, sure, of limiting the vote in a way that was unfair to certain groups, to Black people, in a racist legacy. So do you understand why some people are just averse to the idea of restricting voting with that background in mind?
Sure, of course. I think that we have not a weird tendency, an understandable tendency, but a problematic tendency, I think, in the United States to generalize things. We're not really very good in dealing with specifics and discrete situations. So for instance, our kind of language and thinking and eventually lawmaking about civil rights is something that really started with the situation of Black people in the United States and has since been expanded to other groups and other kinds of situations. And not to say that Black folks are the only people who ever had it bad in the United States. They're not. There was all sorts of oppression against all sorts of other people. But the situation of African Americans in this country was really, it was quite unique. And the responses that we had to it, so far insufficient, were really particular to that case, I think, in lots of ways. So for instance, you know, Jewish people have experienced discrimination in the United States, but it's not really quite the same thing as what African Americans went through. So I don't think you use the same model for both groups. So I think when you're talking about things like, well, how do we handle voting rights? How do we handle the procedures by which we conduct elections and those sorts of things? We should always have that in mind, the situation that has historically been the case with Black Americans, but I don't think that is a reason to necessarily forego doing things that are on their own good policy.
So what are some ways you think we could, we would or should limit or not increase voting that would be fair game?
Yeah, I think that, you know, if I were given my way in every particular, I would have registration periods that weren't very close to election. I would have a standing norm of in-person on paper ballot voting with an ID rather than absentee ballots and some of these other things that are easier to game in various kinds of ways. All of these things probably lead to fewer voters. But I think they would still be worthwhile things to pursue. I think at some point we're going to have a real conversation about who counts as an adult in the United States. And if you can't buy a handgun and you can't buy a beer, but you can join the army and you can vote, that's kind of a weird, unsustainable situation, I think, in a lot of ways. I know there are historical reasons for having it that way. But we increasingly treat Americans of college age as though they were children. When it comes to everything from mental health to the criminal justice system. I think we can have a situation in which we treat 20-year-olds like children, or we can have a situation in which 20-year-olds have a vote. I don't think you can really have both of those things for a long time. I would support raising the voting age right now to about 50, but maybe 48. 48 would be a good number.
I find that one in particular interesting because I've written about this as well. It's so inconsistent. It doesn't make any sense. They either have to all be at 18 or all at 21 in my book. And I'm okay with the arguments for maybe keep moving them to 21.
Sure.
I'm only 23. Actually,
in some ways, a good example of what I was talking about, because if you raise, let's just say we raise the voting age to 30, that would disproportionately affect people who aren't white because the white population skews older and the Latino population in particular and the African-American population skews a bit younger. So the number of people who would lose their vote proportionally by raising the voting age would disproportionately affect people who weren't white. That's something I think we should be aware of and should be part of the conversation, but it doesn't make it a bad policy in and of itself.
Yeah.
What's not good, of course, is that you get a funny situation because obviously, Republicans, when they are writing voting laws, are going to write them in such a way as to advantage themselves. I mean, we know this is what people do. Democrats do the same thing. Redistricting works the same way. Anytime you've got a political body touching how elections are handled, it's going to be a political process. And the reality is that if you are looking to advantage Republicans and to discourage people who are likely to vote for Democrats, that is going to have a disproportionate effect, if you're effective at it, on people who are younger, people who are poor, and people who aren't white.
Yeah, but I guess that brings me to the one of the things that I struggle with on this issue, which is basically it feels like voter ID, for example, Republicans support it, Democrats don't like it. But that's because, broadly speaking, it would help Republicans somewhat. By decreasing turnout, and it would help Democrats somewhat. I am convinced that the parties would embrace the exact opposite position if the impact was reversed.
Sure.
At least many of the elected officials would. And the, but so how do we have any progress or meaningful conversation on these things when so much of it is just partisan tribalism?
Well, right now we don't. There's no meaningful political conversation in the United States. We are engaged in this kind of nationwide culture war in which party affiliation, even though the parties are really quite weak at this point institutionally, functions as a kind of ersatz religion or ethnicity. It's a little like, it's Catholics and Protestants in Northern Ireland in some ways. It wasn't really theological differences that were driving that conflict. It was, essentially you had two tribes in the same territory and they couldn't agree on how to share political power. And we increasingly have the same thing. We have two kind of basic tribes in American political life that are associated with the political parties in relatively predictable ways. There's all sorts of fun things that people in marketing do. Like you can look at a pretty narrow basket of goods, like, where do you buy your groceries and what kind of car do you drive, and predict someone's party registration with a high degree of confidence. People who shop at Walmart Supercenter and own a Ford F-250 are Republicans pretty much across the board. People who own Audis and shop at Whole Foods are pretty much Democrats. I like Whole Foods, but and I hate to engage in the stereotype, but it actually turns out to be true. So, this is tied up in lifestyle stuff and social attitudes, received cultural preferences that are embedded in our communities and families, and lots of things that don't have to do with political policy per se, which is kind of interesting if you look at it. If you look at the polling anyway, and polling always has some limitations, but there's really wide agreement among most Republicans and most Democrats behind things like having a higher minimum wage or behind having significant restrictions on abortion in the first trimester. These things are probably not going to become public policy because of the culture war stuff, but the things that really divide Republicans and Democrats often are not really issues. There are a lot of Republicans, for instance, the rank and file, who support higher corporate taxes and higher levels of regulation. Now, this is something that from a party orthodoxy point of view is unspeakable. You can't even talk about that. But it's not where the people actually are. But what really divides the people is these cultural totems. When I wrote this column, it was funny. I got a lot of response from people who I assume saw it on Twitter or whatnot. And it would be, a picture of some kind of low-life looking white person at a Walmart wearing a Trump hat and saying, "Are these the people you think are great voters?" Or, someone sent me a thing saying, out of the 50 most educated American counties, 45 went for Joe Biden. And I just kind of wanted to tell these people, I wrote a book called The Case Against Trump, right? I oppose this guy's reelection. I am the least shocked person in America that highly educated people living in highly educated neighborhoods did not vote for Donald Trump. This comes as no surprise to me, and it doesn't hurt my feelings or disappoint me in the least. But people just sort of assume, well, I hate you, therefore you must be affiliated with all the things that I hate. And it's a real kind of tribalistic mentality.
Yeah, I did want to ask you about some of the responses you got, because I read your follow-up.
Hilariously stupid, almost every one of them, which is funny because they weren't written by people who are actually themselves stupid. Say what you will about Kevin Cruz. He's not a moron. He's not a dumb guy. He's just useless.
So just for listeners' sake, what were the most common responses you got?
Well, usually it's, someone, you're a racist. all right. And then it's, you're a racist, and here's something that William F. Buckley wrote in 1957 that proves that you're a racist, even though you were born after that sometime. And don't agree with that particular column, actually, and see the world quite differently, but you're somehow responsible for these things that were written by other people a generation before you were born. So quite a bit of that, quite a bit of the stuff I was talking about before that, you must be a Trump guy, sort of stuff. No, not really. I'm a pretty trenchant critic, I think, of the Republican Party and its sundry buffooneries. That kind of stuff mostly. You're a racist, you're a sexist, you are just trying to help Republicans win elections. I don't think I've done very much in the last many years to help Republicans win elections, and I don't really expect that to change, unfortunately.
How do we take the ideas of liberty and sell them to your average person? Hi, my name is Brian Nichols, sales executive and host of The Brian Nichols Show. And as the director of sales development in the greater telecommunications and cybersecurity sector, I spent years working with C-level executives to help them future-proof their company's infrastructure for an uncertain future. And at The Brian Nichols Show, I'm taking that industry experience and bringing it to the liberty movement. Each episode of The Brian Nichols Show features conversations with leading voices in their respective fields of expertise, ranging from CEOs to economists, elected officials, professors, and more. Instead of focusing on libertarians being right, we're teaching the basic fundamentals of sales and their application in the world of politics, teaching you how to ask better questions to help change people's minds. So, where can you find the program? Head to BrianNicholsShow.com or search your favorite podcast app for the program, and then hit that subscribe button to get three phenomenal episodes that'll make you a better advocate for liberty today.
I would get that kind of criticism sometimes from like MAGA people or from conservatives where they didn't like a column I wrote, an article I reported on. They'd be like, how does this help Republicans get elected?
And I'm like, oh, I get that all the time. Exactly those words. In fact, I was at an event that was a book event of mine a couple years ago in a very affluent neighborhood, in older crowd, people who were National Review subscribers. And, I was the first question out of the box was, how does any of this help Republicans win elections? What are you doing to help ensure Republican majority? And I said, nothing. I'm not, that's not what I do. I'm not a political organizer. I'm not a campaign manager. I often disagree with these people on a lot of things. What I do for a living is I'm a writer. I write opinion columns, and sometimes I do some real journalism, go out into the world and do some reporting. And I try to tell people what I see and what I discover and what it seems to me. There are a lot of people who just can't understand that. And or a lot of people who can understand it, but they pretend not to understand it because understanding it's inconsistent with their business model. You know, if you're particularly if you're on talk radio or you're on cable news, you know, you essentially have to act like an extension of the Republican Party and an extension of whoever's campaign currently is running for president in the Republican Party. Because commercially, those shows just don't work without that. And they also don't work without the, this election is the last election in American history if we lose. You know, sort of it's the end. It's either we win or the country's over. And this stuff is just words you don't say on a family podcast, but we all know what it is, and it's dishonest, and it's silly, and it's bad for the country. And one of the things that I think is particularly galling about this is these people who sort of trademark patriot. You know, we are the patriots. We have radio shows on Sirius Patriot XM that really sell out the actual interests of the country and do things that they know are bad for the country and for its political system because it's a good way to make money. And you can make a ton of money doing that stuff. You know, Sean Hannity is seriously rich. He is rock star rich. He is not flying coach or, you know, flying commercial. There's really good money to be had in that. I didn't know there were that many doggy vitamin buyers out there, but I guess there are. And it's a heck of a racket, but it's bad for the country. It's bad for the conservative movement too. And it's bad for ultimately the things that we stand for and want to try to accomplish in the world and in the country.
Yeah. And I guess that is an interesting kind of rabbit hole to go down because I read you, I read Charlie, I read a lot of National Review. I have kind of disparate people I follow in the conservative movement, but a lot of times it kind of does feel, if you're somebody who is more on the libertarian side or not on the Trump train, not a populist, like just embracing nihilism, like everything's going the wrong direction. But are there positive signs that you see, or is it really just not good news on the right now?
Well, the right's got a problem right now. And it's had a problem for a while. Trump is an interesting phenomenon for two reasons. One was that he had really only one political insight in his life, but it was a really, really good one, which was that if you run the Ross Perot campaign inside the Republican Party rather than as a third party candidate, you have a pretty good chance of winning, which he did partly because he's lucky because Hillary Clinton was an incompetent candidate. But the other interesting thing about Trump is that he's not from the world of politics. He's from the world of celebrity and from the world of real celebrity. You know, he's not someone who was Fox News famous. He's someone whose, name for years was a shout out in rap songs. you know, he's reality television famous, which in America is real famous. And celebrity culture is a lot more powerful than the political conversation. As much as we political people like to tell ourselves that the conversations we're having among ourselves are what's really important going on in the country, they're not. One of the most encouraging things I ever saw, it's been a few years now, and you'll know this because the name's on it, but it was a poll that someone took of various political pundits, you know, and what are your attitudes about these people? Do you trust them? Do you think well of them? Yada, yada, yada. You know, you can tell it was old because Keith Olbermann was on the list. So it's been a while since Keith Olbermann's mattered. But with the exception of Rush Limbaugh, the most common answer for every personality they asked about was never heard of him. Never heard of him. You know, people like us have really strong opinions about, I don't know, Rachel Maddow or Hannity or whoever. Most people in America don't know who these people are. Most Americans,
the most famous ones.
No, most Americans could not pick Sean Hannity out of a police lineup. Assuming that you put in some other, you know, kind of Long Island guys who were, you know, sort of similar in some ways. So I think, you know, our political culture is messed up, and the right's politics and culture and economic incentives are in a really bad place. The country at large, I think, muddles on pretty well. You know, one of the things that always drives me nuts about all this, you know, carnage rhetoric, and the country is suffering and it's terrible out there and it's all about to end. Have you ever been to America? Do you drive around? You know, our cities look pretty good for the most part. Our farms look pretty good for the most part. The countryside looks pretty good. The economy's doing pretty well. I mean, we've just gone through this horrible, one of the few literally unprecedented or really nearly unprecedented things that we've seen in our history. And the economy's bounced back from it just fine. Something like 80% of people say that they are either financially better off today or in the same position as they were before the epidemic started and all the shutdowns and all that stuff. That's amazing. That is, you know, some really great flexibility. And we do all sorts of cool stuff in the country still. We invent all sorts of neat things. We all have sorts of cool businesses. You know, when someone sends people to Mars, it's going to be some guy in Texas probably launching a privately funded rocket. And so that stuff's all great. There's a lot of cool stuff that happens in America, but we've got a terrible government and terrible political culture. And unfortunately, I think a lot of organized conservatism in the Republican Party is contributing to what's not good in that political culture rather than trying to act as a corrective to it.
How would you fix it? Or is there a breaking point where it falls apart and then something new emerges?
Yeah, these things are not fixable because you can't manage a culture. You can try to influence it. You can, you know, write books and have arguments and try to make people understand things and give people points of view. But cultures just go where they go. It's like fashion, you know, it's not predictable. You can't say 10 years from now that, well, why are people going to like, you know, big yellow fluffy hoodie sweatshirts that make them look like Big Bird? I don't know, but people may like it one of these days. Who knows? These things are you know, difficult to imagine. They're difficult to predict. So anyone who's, this is one of the things we particularly do on the right is this wishful thinking that if only the schools weren't so biased, if only the media weren't so biased, if only we had some sort of effective propaganda network, then our ideas would flourish and the country would be better. We tell ourselves that story all the time, and I just don't think it's true. Conservative ideas have never been particularly popular because they are difficult and they force us to face unpleasant realities about things like scarcity. They force us to face the unpleasant reality that there are lots of things in your life that may not be your fault, that are still your problem, that you're the only person who can deal with them, even though it's not fair and you didn't get yourself necessarily into that situation. No one wants to hear that. They want to hear, give me a check. You know, I'm going to forgive your student loans and that sort of thing. So we've always got an uphill battle because we are telling unpopular truths that people don't want to hear. And this isn't a matter of, well, if the New York Times were on our side, it'd be different. I mean, yeah, it would be different if the media were different. It would be different if the schools were different, but it wouldn't be that different. Because we've got all sorts of propaganda channels. We've got Fox News and stuff like that. And it's not really moving the needle very much culturally, I don't think, because it's not that people don't hear what conservatives have to say. It's that they mostly don't care or that they reject it.
Yeah, I mean, it's not what I want, but it is true. I guess one thing I want to
pick up. I could interrupt for just one second.
Oh, yeah.
It comes into my head. This goes back to the original point of our conversation, which is that you hear from people sometimes, well, if people reject your ideas, then your ideas must be bad because we're a democracy and what the people choose must be good. And conservatives really have to get past that. And this current, you know, mode of populism is not going to serve us very well. Conservatives have to face the fact that they are never going to be the people's party. And if they become the people's party, they won't be conservatives anymore. They'll be something else. They'll be, you know, right-wing populists or whatever it is the Republican Party is slowly being turned into. The people very often are wrong about things. That's why you need a government. If people were just, you know, in their masses, happy and quiet and peaceful and productive, you wouldn't need a government at all. We have states because people aren't like that and because they need to be governed.
Well, so I want to ask you, though, because it does seem to me increasingly like the traditional definition of conservatism, right? The fusionism, fiscal conservatism with social conservatism and aggressive foreign policy, or however you define traditional conservatism, at least at one point, there was a definition. But now I increasingly feel like conservative is becoming a meaningless word. If anything that can be used to describe both Breitbart and National Review and Rand Paul and Tom Cotton and Josh Hawley. Now, I'm not saying they all are or aren't, but they are all used that label.
Sure.
I guess, and then there's like this nascent war over what does it even mean to be a conservative with people that seemingly agree on nothing, all claiming the mantle. So I just want to get your thoughts on all that.
Yeah, well, yeah, I think the Irish Catholic Protestant thing here is a good example again for this reason, because you had a situation in which most of the people who describe themselves as Catholics weren't people who, you know, went to mass or things like that. They weren't really active in that sense. They weren't really theologically or philosophically Catholic. They were people who were culturally Catholic. They were from Catholic families, Catholic neighborhoods. And it was a matter of affiliation, not a matter of belief. And that's really where our political camps are. They're matters of affiliation, not matters of belief. So we get you get instrumentalist coalitions, and the Democrats have always been better at that than the Republicans are, of building coalitions of shared interests. But even those are really starting to fade in some ways in favor of coalitions of shared hierarchies of social preferences and identity. And I don't see any thing in the culture that suggests to me that that's going to change anytime in the near future. So I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, 20 years down the road, we have, you know, some much more explicit version of the kind of cultural identity we have now, where you've got Republican businesses and Democrat businesses and Republican churches and Democrat churches and Republican neighborhoods and Democrat neighborhoods and Republican brands and Democrat brands and that sort of thing, Republican books. Where essentially everything is to some extent divided on the Fox News versus MSNBC model. And I don't think it's going to be very good for the country. I think it's going to have a real deadening and coarsening effect on the culture and on art and other things and on literature in particular. But it feels to me like that's where things are headed.
All right. Well, that's a tad depressing, but it's an insight nonetheless.
The service I offer is a tad depressing.
Yeah. Insightful, but a tad depressing. All right. To round out the show, I just want to get our listeners always love this last segment. What is your most controversial? You're known for very non-controversial opinions, but maybe on food, you'll have something controversial to say. What's your most controversial food take?
Restaurants are stupid. The whole American culture in which fancy and trendy and expensive restaurants have become so central to our shared community life, I think is really not a good thing for the country. I think, is it Is it the movie When Harry Met Sally, where the guy's written the essay about how restaurants have displaced theater in New York and in popular culture? And I think there really is something to that, where the things that used to be our shared experiences and the things we did with an evening out, back when they were evening outs before we had the plague, was things like parties and music and theater and things like that. And now it's pretty much the new whatever concoction of mashed potatoes. It was lobster mashed potatoes a few years ago, and now it's some other kind of mashed potatoes. I don't know. So I don't like restaurants in general. I'll go to one if that's the option, but I try to avoid them when possible.
That's a unique take. Do you like to cook and clean?
No.
So you just want the best of both worlds.
Fortunately, I'm married to someone who does. So
smart. There you go. Sounds like you've got it made. Kevin Williamson, thanks so much for your time.